It is Friday, April 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, South Korea rejects U.S. President Donald Trump's demand for Seoul to pay $1 billion for THAAD.
The South Korean Defense Ministry said there's no change in the deal that was made last year in which the United States would provide the THAAD missile defense system.
The Taliban launches its spring offensive in Afghanistan, and a copy of the U.S. Declaration of Independence is found in a town in England. It's all ahead. South Korea quickly refuted U.S. President Donald Trump's call for Seoul to pay $1 billion for the THAAD missile defense system. This comes at a time of heightened tensions between the United States and North Korea, including a failed missile launch by Pyongyang and Washington's dispatch of warships to the region. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Patton in Seoul and asked him about South Korea's reaction to Trump's comments on THAAD.
Well, every level has refuted it. The South Korean Defense Ministry said there's no change in the deal that was made last year in which the United States would provide the THAAD missile defense system and that South Korea would provide the supporting facilities and the land, and that South Korea would not pay the $1 billion that Trump has suddenly and unexpectedly called for in an interview just Thursday with Reuters. Not only did the government that is an acting government that is holding on to power here for just less than 2 weeks more before a new president is elected, but the major candidates, the two major candidates in this race, have both refuted it. Both Moon Jae-in from the Democratic Party of Korea, who has long held the position that the THAAD missile defense system should be delayed until the new government comes into power, that now he's saying that given what Mr. Trump has just said, that the deployment of this missile defense system should be immediately suspended until they get to the bottom of any sort of controversy here. Also, this second leading candidate, An Chol-soo, who is with the People's Party, who is also a liberal-leaning candidate and has kind of gone out on a limb to support THAAD in the past against, I think, some of the leaning of his base, he has come out and said that this is not correct. They would not support THAAD under these circumstances, that suddenly the South Korean government would be expected to pay for all of this after the deal was sold in a way that they would not have to pay for it. And he has called for an immediate investigation into what exactly the agreement was between South Korea and the U.S. when this deal was made last year during the administration of President Barack Obama in the U.S. and ex-South Korean President Park Geun-hye, who was removed from office just a couple months ago due to a corruption scandal here, which triggered this whole sudden election process.
This must be very challenging times for South Korea because, as you said, there's the government has been in a somewhat challenging situation because of the change in presidents. But also there's the rising threat of North Korea and some, I guess, misunderstandings or disagreements with the United States, with Washington. So it must be, I think, quite challenging for not just the South Korean government, but for the South Korean people as well.
There's a rising sentiment here in South Korea that is contrary right now to the position of the United States government, whether it was under President Barack Obama or currently under President Trump, which under Trump, it is much more stringent and hardline against North Korea. But there's a movement here in South Korea that has gone unnoticed that may come to fruition very soon with the next presidential election, where there's a much more liberal-leaning administration that will come to power, that this administration will be much more inclined to return to some of these policies in the past decade that were more pro-engagement in North Korea, that were more pro-dialogue, unconditional dialogue with North Korea. And it just needs to be seen if we are seeing right now the beginning of a real conflict between these two long-standing alliance partners. Now, when he was candidate Trump, he had said many disruptive things about the U.S. alliance with South Korea, about how South Korea should pay more for the U.S. troops that are here, and how he would treat North Korea differently. He would have a hamburger with the dictator, and he would get a deal done with North Korea, how he would refute the trade deal with South Korea. And he said all of these things. But after he was elected, there was an orchestrated effort here. You saw one high-level official after another, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Vice President, who was here less than 2 weeks ago. They all came here to say the same thing. They all repeated the same phrases. The alliance between the U.S. and South Korea is enduring, ironclad, unwavering. And then we get this week, that but there is a price. So it's disconcerting here. I think there's a momentum towards a more liberal philosophy towards engagement. And Mr. Trump's comments yesterday probably pushed that even further left.
VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, whoever said that Fridays are a slow day have never been on a Friday in Washington like one today that we're having. So starting on the Korean Peninsula, where Brian Padden was just talking about President Trump making social media headlines after warning about a major, major conflict with North Korea. And a lot of questions about maybe some trade deals hanging in the balance. And then the bigger question, are we heading towards war or escalated conflict with North Korea? Those questions swirling on social media. At the same time, we have Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's strong condemnation of North Korea at the United Nations. And that video is making the rounds on social media today. And at the same time this discussion about Korea is happening, we're talking about President Trump's first 100 days, which we're approaching. He's said that this is what he feels is an artificial marker, but has not stopped the White House from having a big push for his first 100 days in office, a website outlining some of the accomplishments. And that's where a lot of the talk is on social media. A lot of the talk about the successes, like filling the Supreme Court vacancy, the numerous executive orders that have been rolled out, to the failures. No health repeal. He said that was something he wanted to get done in the first 100 days. No tax plan. Although that's been released by the White House, it hasn't been passed by Congress. So a lot of back and forth, even in this first 100 days, assessing the very early legacy of the president and how the administration is going so far. President Trump's also making social media headlines in an interview that he gave to Reuters, where he said that on being president, the work is more, there's more work than in my previous life. I thought it would be easier. So that's getting a lot of attention on social media. Many saying that shows that he's unqualified to be president. He's not interested in being president. But a lot of people pointing out as well that President Obama has made similar comments about being in the bubble and the frustrations of being president and how much it entails. So they're saying that it's along lines with those comments. And then at the same time as all that's going on, President Trump signing some executive orders expanding drilling in the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans, coming just a day before tomorrow's climate change march here on the National Mall. That's getting a lot of attention on social media. And Congress has avoided a government shutdown. Literally in the last day, it was set to shut down at midnight. They have passed a stopgap measure. Frustration that it is only a stopgap measure, only lasting for a week, and questions about what happens next week and the week after that and the week after that. So lots to talk about on social media, lots going on here in Washington. I think it's safe to say, as many people have expressed on social media, they are ready for the weekend.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. on North Korea. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says all options are on the table. Pakistani parliamentarians will meet Afghan counterparts in Kabul. The Thai military steps up security in restive Muslim border provinces. And Russia cracks down on its opposition ahead of a planned protest. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using two of NASA's X-ray space telescopes, as well as the Australia Telescope Compact Array, say they have found evidence of the tightest orbit of a companion star around a black hole. The star, a white dwarf, is said to circle the black hole at a rate of 2 times an hour from a distance equal to 2.5 times the separation between Earth and the Moon. The black hole white dwarf system was identified as X9, located in a Milky Way globular star cluster nearly 15,000 light-years from Earth. The scientists say the white dwarf is so close to the cosmic abyss that stellar material is being stripped away and dumped into a disk of matter surrounding the black hole before it's pulled in by the tremendous gravity. While they don't think the white dwarf is in any danger of falling in or being torn apart by the black hole, the researchers say its fate is uncertain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Pope Francis arrives in Egypt. The Taliban has begun its spring offensive in Afghanistan and vowed to target U.S.-led foreign forces in the country. I spoke with Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, and asked him if this campaign by the Taliban is an annual event.
Yes, that has been sort of a routine activity since the Taliban was ousted from power in 2001, and especially when they launched their insurgency. They have been basically, every year they wait for the spring season to set in so that they could move their equipment and their fighters in large number to areas where they want to launch the attacks. But let me tell you that this spring offensive, they have formally announced it, but all the observers would agree that this has become an obsolete idea in recent years because there has been no lull in fighting in Afghanistan even during harsh winter. So apparently it is all aimed at sort of a psychological attack on Afghan security forces, which are already under pressure because of the Taliban attacks. So as the Afghan government has put it, that it is more like a propaganda tool than an actual war activity, because there has been no lull in the fighting over the last 2 years.
Yeah, and this announcement today just follows by a week when the Taliban launched a raid onto the Afghan military base in Mazar-e-Sharif, where many were killed.
That's true. And in fact, at that time, when the Taliban took responsibility for that attack on this major military base, they also mentioned that this was like a prelude to their spring offensive. So they had already announced their intention of going ahead with the spring offensive, despite pressure from regional countries, including Pakistan, that the Taliban should stop violence and engage in peace talks with the Afghan government. But with that brutal attack, they sent a clear message that they are determined to continue with the fighting. And that's what everybody has anticipated, that it's going to be a very tough year for both the sides.
Now, this also follows the United States dropped a huge bomb on Afghanistan. It was targeting Islamic State areas, caves in that area. How does the Taliban and Islamic State, how do they operate apart from Islamic State?
Well, the Taliban are basically, you know, unhappy with the emergence of Islamic State on the Afghan scene. And we have seen regular clashes between the two militant groups in recent months. In fact, over the last few days, there has been fighting between Islamic State militants and the Taliban in western Afghanistan in the Herat province. So obviously, the way the Taliban has gone ahead with its spring offensive, they also know that they are going to face, in certain areas of Afghanistan, Islamic State fighters. So this time for the Taliban, in this year particularly, there's going to be two different fronts, one against the Afghan security forces and the other against Islamic State. And with this dropping of mother of all the bombs by the United States in eastern Nangarhar province, where Islamic State primarily has its headquarters, obviously the way the Taliban is looking at it when I talked to their spokesman is that it was sort of a message that the U.S. military sent to the Taliban that they will not hesitate in dropping these kind of weapons against the Taliban when it is necessary on the battlefield. So in order to overcome that psychological effect or to neutralize that psychological effect on their fighters, that is what observers say in Afghanistan. The Taliban went ahead and they launched this unprecedented attack against this army, Afghan army base in northern Mazar-e-Sharif, and massacred so many Afghan soldiers to also send a message to the U.S. military that they are also prepared to undertake massive attacks.
Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. Pope Francis began a two-day visit to Egypt today, beginning in Cairo. VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke to reporter Edward Uranian, who's covering the Pope's visit to the Egyptian capital.
A high point of the visit has been the interfaith conference that was arranged by Al-Azhar University. This had been programmed quite a long time ago. The Pope had met with the Imam, the Grand Imam, Ahmed Tayyib, in the Vatican back in November. I believe that's when they originally decided that they were going to hold this meeting. There are religious leaders from various parts of the globe, various religions, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, the Coptic Pope, Tewodros II, Coptic Catholic Pope, Ibrahim Ishaq, also various other religious groups from places like Lebanon and Syria. And they were discussing basically the need for dialogue between the different religions for peace. The Pope said God is peace, that it's incompatible to have violence in the name of God, that God wants us to cooperate and be friends. And the Grand Imam said basically that in this 21st century of human rights and globalization, that we're witnessing an unprecedented barbarity.
What happens on day two of the visit?
Well, the Pope seems to have been restricted in his movements. I guess the security situation is not entirely wonderful, so they clearly don't want him going too far astray. He's been limited to areas around central Cairo in the district where the Papal Nuncio's office is located, also out in a fairly leafy suburb to the south. He's supposed to attend Mass tomorrow. He's supposed to meet head-to-head with Coptic Pope Tewodros this evening. And he's actually leaving tomorrow, I believe, around 5 o'clock, which means he will have been here for just a little over a day. There were initial intentions of staying longer, but I believe that the security situation has prevented that.
Edward Uranian reporting from Cairo. This is...
When news breaks... VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. An extremely rare copy of the U.S. Declaration of Independence has been found stored in a vault in the southern English town of Chichester. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the document is thought to date from the 1780s and is only one of two ceremonial parchment copies of the Declaration.
The handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence has been stored for more than 60 years in a strong room among cartons of other documents. However, two Harvard University researchers, Danielle Allen and Emily Sneff, recently told British archivists in the West Sussex Records Office of the document's significance. Wendy Walker is the West Sussex archivist.
I mean, we knew we had it, we knew what it was, but we didn't have the knowledge that they have brought to it in terms of the connection with the original, I think. And so to have two Harvard academics turn up on your doorstep and start asking all these fascinating questions about one of your documents, you know, was really exciting.
The 60 by 76 centimeter document contains the text of the Declaration and the names of the signers, including John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. Unlike the original, however, the names are not grouped by states. The so-called Sussex Declaration is thought to date to the 1780s, and researchers believe that it was originally owned by the 3rd Duke of Richmond, who supported American colonists during the Revolutionary War. Wendy Walker says the document raises a lot of questions and doesn't provide the answers.
How did it get to Sussex? How did it end up here? But behind all of those questions are the questions of when was it made, where was it made, why was it made, and who was it made for, and then how did it get here?
While other printed copies of the Declaration exist, the only other ceremonial parchment copy is the Matlack Declaration, which dates from 1776 and is kept behind glass at the National Archives in Washington. The Sussex Declaration will be sent to the British Library for studies on the ink and the parchment. West Sussex County archivist Wendy Walker says that advanced technology will help provide some of the answers to nagging questions about the document's date and provenance.
They will do hyperspectral imaging, which is looking at the document to see things that the naked eye can't see. So there'll be a whole series of tests and forensic examination being done on it over the summer, hopefully to give us a few more answers.
The Sussex office houses hundreds of documents that date back as far as 1,200 years ago. The Sussex Declaration will stay there, under lock and key, until it is transferred to the British Library. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thank you, David. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has informed the U.S. Congress that through April 18th, Iran has complied with its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. At the same time, he announced that the United States is undertaking a government-wide review of U.S. policy toward Iran, including whether suspension of sanctions related to Iran under the JCPOA is vital to the national security interests of the United States. At a press briefing, Secretary Tillerson spoke of Iran's alarming and ongoing provocations that export terror and violence, destabilizing one country at a time. Secretary Tillerson said that left unchecked, Iran has the potential to travel the same path as North Korea, and that the United States does not intend to discover for the second time that strategic patience is a failed approach. Mr. Tillerson pointed to Iran's support for the brutal Assad regime in Syria, which has prolonged a conflict that has killed some 500,000 Syrians and displaced millions more. In Iraq, he noted, Iran has used its Quds force to undermine security in that country for years. Iran provides weapons, training, and funding to Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist organizations dedicated to the destruction of Israel. In Yemen, Iran supports the Houthi rebels who are attempting to overthrow the government and threaten the southern border of Saudi Arabia. Other provocative Iranian behavior includes undermining freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf, conducting cyber attacks on the U.S. and its Gulf partners, plotting terrorist attacks throughout the world, including a plot to kill Abdul al-Jubayr when he was a Saudi ambassador to the United States. Secretary Tillerson also pointed to the government's human rights abuses against the Iranian people, as well as its record of unjustly detaining foreigners, including U.S. citizens. After concluding the comprehensive review of U.S. policy toward Iran, Secretary Tillerson said the United States will meet the challenge Iran poses with clarity and conviction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.